The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Derek Frost for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading from the Triangle Business Journal. And we'll start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the cover story headline, Faces to Watch. Much is at stake for these 11 individuals in the Raleigh-Durham area as they shape their companies, organizations, and their communities for a better tomorrow. And the cover stories begin inside the Triangle Business Journal with another headline. Starting with the notes from the editor-in-chief, Faces to Watch, were we right with our 2021 watch list? You start the year by placing an extra eye on a few individuals you think will have a transformative year because their work could become immensely important for the community. And just like most years, we did pretty well in picking, but could have left a few out of the spotlight. Among the 9 individuals we selected back in December of 2020 to make some noise in 2021, some made more noise than we anticipated, while others were somewhat muted. From the start, it was clear 2021 would be a monster year for the capital markets and for Wall Street. In that regard, we missed the boat in picking an individual who lives and breathes finance. That would have been a surefire good call. Public companies are flush with wealth thanks to the stock market registering historic highs despite some hiccups late in the year. Of course, one of our picks, Jim Dayton of BioAgilytics, benefited from the buoyant capital markets as his new private equity partner now wants to take the local company to new heights by rolling up even more companies. Conversely, we wanted to keep an eye on Catherine Truitt, the new superintendent of the North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. Well, we can't report much action on that front because, frankly, most of the talk during 2021 regarding schools has been about mask mandates and teacher salaries. And now we have a new wave of concerned citizens dissenting on certain things being taught at our schools. We have identified 11 individuals to place under the microscope and follow their progress in 2022. From real estate to healthcare and from technology to economic development, these businesses and organization leaders could make a long-lasting impact on our communities with decisions they will make this year. Here's a look back at our picks from last year. And that was written by Sugata Mukherjee, Editor-in-Chief, Triangle Business Journal. Listed as a great call, Arvind Krishna and Jim Whitehurst, CEO and former president of IBM. Before the year started, we knew IBM's leadership would make some major changes in order to adjust to the fast-moving tech world, and what do you know, it started with the leadership. In July, Jim Whitehurst stepped down as IBM's president but remained as a senior advisor to CEO Arvind Krishna and other executives. Whitehurst was president and CEO of Red Hat from 2008 until 2020. IBM acquired the open-source software company for $34 billion in July 2019. While Krishna continues to build upon IBM's gains, frankly, much of which is coming from its Raleigh unit in Red Hat, one thing became clear. Whitehurst wants to become a CEO again, and he's not going to wait years for that to happen. A meh call, Marshall Adams David, City Manager, Raleigh. When Marshall Adams David was chosen as the first black woman to be named manager of the city of Raleigh, we thought the city would hyper-push the need to add more affordable housing or even announce future projects that will add affordable housing. Well, if you look at historical numbers, perhaps Raleigh and Adams David were successful in their efforts since more affordable housing development news came out in 2021 than in recent years. But it's simply not enough, period. Housing prices are out of control, and unless there is some serious amount of money poured into the effort, along with private developers, we will fall behind even further. Adams David did make big news in 2021, hiring the city's police chief in June. Estella Patterson, deputy chief of the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department, was named Raleigh's police chief. Patterson understands the issues police departments are facing across the country during a new era of policing, Adams David said. Patterson is the city's 30th chief. A great call in Jim Dayton, CEO, BioAgilytics. This was Jim Dayton's biggest year at the company, which is now generating about $75 million in profits. In November, buyout firm Cinven announced it is buying the controlling shares of the Durham Drug Research Services Company in what reportedly slapped a $2.5 billion value on BioAgilytics. While talks of the big M&A were happening during the fourth quarter, BioAgilytics was busy buying companies to scale up its top line and its product offerings. In fact, the company bought two entities in 1 week. In the meantime, BioAgilytics continues to hire in Durham, where last year it pledged to add nearly 900 positions. The company has about 450 employees in Durham and more than 760 overall. BioAgilytics was founded in Durham in 2008 and acquired by a Belgium-based private investment firm 10 years later. Dayton estimated earlier this year that the firm will finish 2021 at more than $170 million in revenue. A good call. Peter Hans, president, UNC System. It looks like Peter Hans will have a new office soon. Very quietly, thanks to Senate leader Phil Berger, the offices of the University of North Carolina System are moving to Raleigh, and apparently few people knew about it. A few months ago, Hans was also came under pressure for not taking sides on vaccine and mask mandates at UNC campuses. He deferred any mandate to the state's public health experts, and that did not sit well with a good portion of the faculty and student body. But Hans did recommend that faculty and students in the school system should get vaccinated or regularly tested when using UNC facilities at campuses. And then there was the debacle over journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones that eventually put UNC Chapel Hill in the spotlight. Jones turned down a faculty position offer from UNC after the university went through a contentious vote that bubbled up with issues of racism, critical race theory studies, and tenure. Most observers blamed the North Carolina General Assembly for stacking up the college board with partisan individuals. Under state law, the legislature selects all 24 voting members of the UNC Board of Governors. That board oversees the president of the UNC system and has the power to fire and hire chancellors. It also appoints the majority of trustees on boards across the UNC campuses. A good call, Jessica Brock, managing director Longfellow. We were not sure if this pick was worth a spotlight for 2021, but then came August. That month, Longfellow unveiled plans for the next phase of the Durham Innovation District. The project calls for a 7-story office and lab building at the site of the historic Imperial Building in downtown Durham. Last month, Longfellow filed plans with the city showing 196,000 square feet of commercial space at 518 West Morgan Street and 215 Morris Street. The property is the site of the Durham Imperial Building, built in 1916. Plans show the new building will sit right next to the existing structure. Marketing materials say the building will accommodate lab and manufacturing uses, and that Longfellow hopes to deliver the building by the end of 2022. But that's not all, as Jessica Brock was on a roll. In September, the company paid $15 million for a 35-acre assemblage called Triangle 54, with plans to develop 456,000 square feet of ground-up, purpose-built buildings for life science tenants. This particularly was a big deal for folks at Research Triangle Park, who are trying to desperately add some scale so others will join the effort to reinvent RTP, especially at a time when Apple may start working on its campus design in the next months. A blown call, Catherine Truitt, Superintendent, North Carolina Department of Public Instruction. Catherine Truitt made news for a short period of time for the wrong reasons, first supporting a state bill that seeks to limit what can be taught in public schools relating to teaching surrounding critical race theory. And then she went on to cancel a contract with the ISKME, the Institute for the Study of Knowledge Management in Education. The DPI had hired the independent education nonprofit to train educators in culturally responsive teaching. The teaching practice recognizes the importance of including students' cultural references in all forms of learning. But Truitt did make some inroads in implementing her Operation Polaris initiative in 2021. The project is what Truitt calls a roadmap for transforming public schools that eventually will have a qualified teacher in every classroom. Her move to beef up the Office of Learning Recovery and Acceleration could pay dividends down the road. Operation Polaris also addresses the need to improve literacy levels, human capital, testing, and student support services. A good call on Paul Zarian, director of Hines. This really was a low-hanging fruit for us. We knew Hines, an international real estate firm based in Houston, had chartered huge development plans in Cary, calling it the Fenton Development. What we did not know was that 2021 may have been the pivotal year for Fenton, Hines, and the town of Cary. Work at Fenton is well underway as crews top out buildings in the project's first phase, and developers say they're on track for an April opening. And Paul Zarian is overseeing this billion-dollar-plus development. Developers, Hines, Columbia Development and USAA Real Estate have spent the last year plus transforming the 69-acre site into a large mixed-use destination with office and mixed-use apartment buildings rising six stories, overlooking amenity and additional retail space. Altogether, Phase 1 includes 345,000 square feet of retail, restaurants, and entertainment space, 200,000 square feet of office space, a 175-key boutique hotel, and a 357-unit luxury apartment community. Another blown call, Tunde Satunde, CEO, Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina. We thought 2021 would be a big year from BCBSNC, primarily because the state's largest health insurer would face a new set of challenges following the worst months of the pandemic in 2020. Well, COVID is still with us, and while Dr. Tunde Satunde has made some strides toward offering parity regarding addressing the needs of the uninsured, Blue Cross has largely remained under the radar. Sure, there were some major disagreements, such as the American Society of Anesthesiologists condemning Blue Cross's alleged abuse of the No Surprises Act to coerce clinicians and practices into network agreements, but issues like this arise almost every year. We also never heard anything about how insurers will address reimbursing doctors and healthcare agents relating to remote care delivery. Maybe there is a plan, and we are not aware of it, but either way, it did not create passionate debate across the healthcare community. And finally, from last year, a good call, James Sills, CEO, M&F Bank. James Sills had a decent year when Bank of America and then J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, and Citibank all pledged to help minority-led financial institutions build up their capital base so they can be more active in their own communities. Then Food Lion came in and said it will increase deposit by $50 million to their account with M&F. The more deposits banks have, the more loans it can make. But overall, when Sills' bank increased deposits and is better capitalized, nothing remarkable happened for Sills that would have made the entire community pay attention. And now we turn to the faces to watch in 2022. Ralph Barrick, UNC Chapel Hill. Ralph Barrick, a UNC Chapel Hill professor and leading expert on coronaviruses, has had a busy past few years, and that doesn't seem to be changing anytime soon. Barrick began his research on coronaviruses while doing postdoc work at the University of Southern California. At the time, this group of viruses were relatively understudied, not anymore. Barrick isn't surprised a coronavirus has caused a pandemic, but is nonetheless shocked all the same. We had done a lot of work in the 1990s to show that coronaviruses readily jump between species, suggesting that they were emerging viruses, Barrick says. And humans, how different are we really? If they can jump between a pig to a cow and a bat to a bird, eventually your species is going to get exposed and potentially experience a new pathogen. In addition to this research, Barrick's lab has studied coronavirus treatments that have been approved by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration or seem to be approaching that mark. This includes the drug Remdesivir, which the FDA approved in early 2020 to treat hospitalized COVID-19 patients, and Molnupiravir, which an FDA committee recommended for authorization in late November. Barrick's lab also helped with the development of the Moderna COVID-19 vaccine. Participating in the Moderna Phase 3 clinical trial when they stuck the vaccine in my arm made it very, very real that I had helped accomplish something that could make a difference, he says. Barrick received numerous accolades for his work throughout 2021, including from the state, Barrick's University, and the Triangle Business Journal, but his work continues just as the pandemic continues. With the emergence of the Omicron variant, Barrick's lab has been busy learning the biology of the virus. Barrick says the lab will also work with commercial groups that are interested in whether the drug they've developed works against the variant. Aside from this research, Barrick is trying to prevent future pandemics from happening. He helped co-found a collaboration between academia, private companies, philanthropic organizations, and government resources called the Rapidly Emerging Antiviral Drug Development Initiative, or READDI, spelled R-E-A-D-D-I. The goal is to develop a number of antiviral drugs that could be effective against entire families of emerging viruses to treat people during future epidemics or pandemics. The initiative is aiming to have five drugs ready for phase one testing within 5 years. Helping move this program forward, which has already received funding from the state and commercial partners, will be a focus for Barrick in 2022, as will his lab's work in helping the world respond to the ongoing pandemic. Sadly enough, I expect a couple more variants to occur before we begin to see the end of this pandemic, Barrick says. And so to be prepared to help respond to that and to continue our efforts to contribute to the global response to this pandemic and to better prepare for future ones, it's the goal of the lab, and that's what we'll continue to do. And that was written by Zach Ezone. The next is Miriam Baer, North Carolina Real Estate Commission. In her 34 years at the North Carolina Real Estate Commission, Executive Director Miriam Baer hadn't seen anything like the past 2 years. Even after the pandemic hit, the real estate market in the Triangle and across North Carolina continued to explode, and applicants poured in to find training and get their real estate licenses. And it wasn't clear how the commission was going to make all that work. All of a sudden, people were being advised to work from home, she says. We advised our education providers not to conduct courses in person anymore. We thought a while was 6 or 8 weeks. Looking back, I feel naive, she says. The pivot to safety protocols took time, even as the applications for new licenses arrived faster than ever. While workers around the state lost jobs, residential real estate saw one of its best years in as new residents slammed into housing shortages amid seller apprehension at having strangers in their home and concerns about finding another home to buy when the sale does go through. That meant plenty of potential for an enterprising realtor, and more people wanted in. My speculation is that people in other sectors are losing their jobs and looking for something with realistic entry requirements, Baer says. To get a license, you need a 75-hour class and pass a licensing exam. That's easier than going back to law school or getting a medical degree. And the application fee is $100 and renewal is $45, so it's not expensive either. Thousands of applications flooded the office, but the shift to online training and testing was rocky, with many people were failing for their first time. Part of our spike in numbers is because people had to go back and study some more, Baer says. The commission is offering in-person classes again. In the 2020 to 2021 fiscal year, the commission saw a whopping 18,001 applications for licenses. That's up from 12,396 the year before and 11,810 2 years ago. Reapplications weren't the only cause of the surge. The commission also sent out more than 1,000 licenses last year than the year prior, 11,594 compared to 10,406 the year before. And the total number of brokers continues to surge. Last year saw a total of 107,556 agents, up from 100,444 the year before that and 97,459 the year before that. Baer says some changes will be permanent. There will be a lot more choices. Online instruction isn't going to go away again, she says. For many prospective agents, that can help, especially those who are in rural areas or out of state. Baer also says she expects the new world of virtual showings and electronic sales to continue. We're going to see more electronic showings. In general, I'd still advise any buyer to actually visit a property before they obligate themselves to buy it, she says. I may be old-fashioned in that way, but for most consumers, it could be the biggest transaction in their life, and there are things that your eye can see that a camera cannot. And that was written by Caleb Harshberger. Our next face to watch in 2022, written by Cameron Snipes, concerns Kevin Dick, Carolina Small Business Development Fund. A peer at Kevin Dick's LinkedIn profile reveals a background made up of nearly 25 years of public service roles. Those include a stint in the late 1990s when he served as assistant to the city manager of Dania Beach, Florida, to director of the Office of Economic and Workplace Development for the city of Durham, to deputy director of economic development for Charlotte. In February 2020, Dick became president and CEO of the Carolina Small Business Development Fund. He leads a nonprofit of more than 30 staffers that helps small businesses with lending, technical assistance and growth, and policy research and development. CSBDF is a community development financial institution, meaning it provides credit and financial services to underserved markets and populations. CSBDF has funded approximately 1,100 loans and over 1,000 grants, totaling more than $82 million and helping create or retain 4,672 jobs across North Carolina. The organization started in 1990 as the North Carolina Minority Support Center, lending money to minority-owned banks and community-based credit unions. In 2011, it transitioned to CSBDF and began lending directly to small businesses. It became a chartered community development financial institution in 2013. The prime loan target for the nonprofit, Dick says, is between $50,000 and $75,000, most often to businesses that have fewer than 20 employees. CSBDF saw a 400% year-over-year increase in loan production from 2019 and 2020, and the nonprofit has increased its activity significantly over the last year. Since January 2021, we've really focused on ramping up our technical assistance and grant aid efforts, Dick says. That has included making 235 emergency grant aid awards for $3.9 million and providing 667 entrepreneurs with 1,859 hours of counseling, mentoring, and customized training. We're now beginning to see the fruits of those efforts as many clients are planning to expand their businesses, and we're excited to be able to meet their capital needs in the coming year. Areas of focus going forward, Dick says, include providing technical assistance to potential borrowers, being a thought leader, and growing and cultivating partnerships with organizations that want to help small businesses but may not have the capacity to do so. Dick says the primary strategy will be education and working with businesses to help them understand that they cannot meaningfully scale long-term without debt. Businesses are still struggling to recover and may be afraid to scale, even though when there are opportunities to do so, he says. A few of the initiatives ahead include the nonprofit again partnering with City of Raleigh on a financial and technical assistance program called Oak City Biz Labs. A partnership will also continue with Durham City and Durham County on a low-cost loan program for businesses. CSBDF will also launch its new debt fund that has been supported by Charter Communications, Dick says. This is a $1 million source of debt that will enable up to provide small businesses loans between $5,000 and $250,000 statewide, he says. And our next person, this is written by Lauren Onosorge, is Jim Goodnight, SAS. The Triangle and the world are watching one of the richest men in North Carolina, wondering what the tech titan will do next and whether SAS could hit the public markets anytime soon. Jim Goodnight, longtime CEO of SAS Institute in Cary, made headlines in 2021 for a series of exit rumors, fueling speculation that 2022 could be a big year for the company. First, there were reports of a potential buyout by semiconductor giant Broadband, a deal the Wall Street Journal reported as being valued at between $15 billion and $20 billion. Goodnight issued a flat denial the next day, sending a message to employees saying SAS was not up for sale. Then just 2 weeks later, Goodnight released a video saying SAS would take the appropriate steps to prepare our business for entry into the public markets. Goodnight, who turned 79 on January 6, said SAS planned to be ready for an initial public offering by 2024, and that the firm would refine its financial reporting structure and streamline operational processes to prepare for a market debut. While some thought it might be a mating call to potential buyers, particularly with the long timeline, SAS officials have repeatedly stood by Goodnight's statement that the firm is not for sale and that the focus right now is on investing in AI and analytics. And Goodnight has squashed exit rumors before. In 2007, he reportedly refused two offers from an unidentified firm to buy SAS. Insiders have said there have been multiple offers over the years, followed by multiple rejections. The latest exit headlines are swirling as SAS, an analytics stalwart since Goodnight and John Saul founded the company more than four decades ago out of NC State University, faces more competition than ever. Emerging players are aiming millions of venture capital-funded innovations squarely on the turf of legacy companies like SAS. And the pressure is on for Goodnight and the team to keep delivering, which is why they've made major R&D investments in recent years, such as the $1 billion it announced it would be funneling into AI in 2019. SAS has enjoyed major benefits from its private company status, taking the long view and avoiding stock-driven analysis downgrades. But a public offering could assist Goodnight in estate planning. Goodnight has not released any succession plans, at least not since naming the former chief operating officer, Oliver Schabenberger, as his heir apparent. Schabenberger, however, left the company a year ago to join San Francisco-based Single Store, and that's brought renewed attention to what would happen if Goodnight ever decided to move on from the company he has led closely since its inception. Zach Ezone writes our next profile of Laura Gunter of NC Bio. Sam Taylor helped found the North Carolina Biosciences Organization in 1994 and served as NC Bio's president from 2006 until he died of pancreatic cancer in February. Laura Gunter, who served as interim president while Taylor was sick, rose to the position in July after serving as director of membership development and government affairs since joining NC Bio in 2013. She steps into the role when the state's booming life sciences industry is at a pivotal moment. Neil Fowler, former CEO of Liquidia and the chairman of NC Bio's board of directors, says the state has a tiger by the tail. Everybody realizes that something is different now, he says. People feel like we're really on the cusp of taking off with life sciences in North Carolina. This makes it an opportunistic time for Gunter to step in and lead the organization, Fowler says, and she spent the latter half of 2021 balancing a number of issues. Gunter talked with Congress about drug pricing legislation, such as what's included in the Build Back Better Act, and how a slowdown in the pharmaceutical industry could impact North Carolina. At the state level, Gunter successfully advocated for lawmakers to support the One North Carolina Small Business Program, which supports small businesses that apply for and receive support through certain federal programs that require matching dollars. The state's program has existed for years but did not always receive funding. The budget Governor Roy Cooper signed in November includes $5 million for the program, including $2 million in recurring money. Gunter says the organization will continue to pursue other means of funding in 2022. This means advocating for the state to develop programs that assist early-stage life sciences companies that need support before reaching the point where they can attract venture capital dollars. In addition, the organization is focused on the issues involving workforce development. With the number of new projects coming to the Triangle and the hundreds of jobs associated with each, it's important members of the industry, those in higher education and state lawmakers, find ways to grow the number of available workers. Gunter says this is something the state has done well in the past and needs to focus on again. This effort also needs to include ways to increase diversity around the industry. We're really trying to be all-inclusive, and if we're not, then we're not going to fill the talent pipeline, she says. Gunter also says NC Bio is also looking at how it operates and whether it needs to make any changes, such as growing its services or charging more for membership. The organization began as a small advocacy organization to monitor what was happening in the state legislature. Since then, it's taken on a more proactive role in advocating on behalf of its members in the life sciences industry. What do we want to be, Gunter says. Do we want to be a much bigger organization? And if we do, then how do we get there? Next, it's Ted Klink of Highwoods. When Ted Klink became CEO of Highwoods Properties in 2019, there was no way to predict what the next 2 years had in store. But despite a pandemic that smashed the office sector, Highwoods has made major investments in the Triangle and around the country, pivoted out of two markets and into Charlotte, and built a hefty portfolio of developable sites. Its properties, especially in its home base of Raleigh, position Highwoods to have a dramatic impact on the shape of the city, a shape that is evolving as companies such as Highwoods weigh the future of office space. The big buys in Raleigh continued as Highwoods ramped up after its massive sell-off of properties in Greensboro and Memphis, Tennessee, as a part of its plan to exit those markets and ramp up in faster-growing markets such as Charlotte and the Triangle. In a recent earnings call, Klink touted the company's Class A office properties in desirable locations. As a war for talent accelerates, we are strong believers that well-located office space and highly amenitized best business districts will become a competitive recruiting advantage for employers, he said. This flight to higher quality buildings in the best locations and with capitalized owners plays to our strengths, he said. In the Triangle, the company kicked off 2021 by buying out Germany's Balandis Real Estate AG's 75% interest in the Forum in North Raleigh. Then in the summer, the company purchased a massive portfolio from Preferred Apartment Communities of Atlanta for a total investment of around $680 million. The properties included the CapTrust Tower and the Wells Fargo Capital Center in Raleigh, as well as the Capitol Towers and the Morrowcroft Center in Charlotte, and the Galleria 75 in Atlanta. In that deal, Highwoods also acquired a leasehold interest for the property at 121 Fayetteville Street in Raleigh, where the seller planned a 32-story tower. Highwoods has yet to announce additional details. That property joins a number of developable sites the company has around the Triangle. In 2021, the company successfully petitioned the city of Raleigh to rezone a lot in the Warehouse District, allowing up to 40 stories of development. The company has yet to file additional plans or designs. Highwoods Properties also has land remaining at its Glen Lake office park off Edwards Mill Road. Meanwhile, Highwoods may be looking for a new home after selling its current headquarters to Raleigh businessman Dean Debnam. Highwoods officials declined to comment following the sale. The new year brings with it a bevy of opportunities and challenges, as the Omicron variant may delay hopes for a mass return to the office. In the Triangle, market watchers will be keeping their eyes on Highwoods developable downtown sites, but until the office sector gains more strength, it's unclear when the company would be looking to make such a sizable investment in a new downtown Raleigh office tower or two. And that was written by Caleb Harshberger. Dane Huffman writes our next profile of Nina King of Duke University. Duke University has had a steady string of giants run its athletics department. Wallace Wade, Eddie Cameron, and Carl James set the Blue Devils up for success. Tom Butters hired unheralded Mike Krzyzewski as a men's basketball coach and extended his contracts when fans howled as the team struggled in early years. And Kevin White's steady hand led to him being named Division I's top athletics director for 2012 to 2013. Now, the Blue Devils enter a new era and with a new look. Nina King, who had been senior deputy director of athletics for administration and legal affairs, moved into the job September 1 when White retired. King is the first person of color and first woman to hold the Duke job. She moves into the athletics director's role at a time of enormous change in collegiate sports, a change in many ways she represents. "I do feel a great responsibility, and I embrace that," King said at a May news conference. "I want to show little girls who look like me that this is possible." Earlier in 2021, she told the school's academic council that about 19% of athletics department staff are people of color and 35% of athletes are from underrepresented groups. King said that 19% number is progress from where we were 10 years ago and mentioned that Duke has 3 black head coaches. "But we're not resting because we've got work to do to continue to increase those numbers," she said. Of course, King's hire would be the highest profile in that regard, as only 2 other black women, Candace Story Lee at Vanderbilt University and Carla Williams at the University of Virginia, are athletic directors at Power 5 conferences. But despite the groundbreaking nature of the appointment, King will face the same challenges many of her Duke predecessors did, starting with football. David Cutliffe's 14-year run as coach ended November 28. Since Bill Murray finished at Duke in 1965, the only Blue Devils coach to post a winning record at the school was Steve Spurrier, who closed a 3-year run in 1989. King, in her first major move, hired Texas A&M University assistant Mike Elko. Elko was a Wake Forest University assistant before leaving for College Station. What Duke fans care most about is men's basketball. Krzyzewski wraps up his brilliant run this season, and current assistant John Shire steps in as the head coach next year. And Shire is off to a fantastic start with the top-ranked recruiting class joining him for his first year as head coach. Duke's athletics budget took a whack from the pandemic. The Duke Chronicle reported the department expected a budget gap of more than $5 million, and like her peers, King will be looking at ways to strengthen revenue streams. But the athletics department overall is strong. The Blue Devils finished 21st for the 2020 to 21 academic year in the Learfield IMG College Director's Cup, a sign of strength across the board in athletics. And then again, like so often at Duke over the last half century, there is still football to solve. Our next profile, written by David Pertell, is of Mark Lawson, Cary Chamber. There's plenty going on in the Cary business community, from projects such as the Fenton development and the new Epic Games headquarters to a buzzing downtown that keeps attracting new spots to dine out and socialize. In the middle of it is Mark Lawson, the new president of the Cary Chamber of Commerce. Lawson, who has lived in Cary for about 25 years, took over in October after Howard S. Johnson, who led the organization for 35 years, retired. What he says all the time is, "It's always about the people. They're the key to the quality of life and the feel of our community," Lawson says about what he learned from Johnson. Lawson had served as senior vice president of economic development for the chamber since 2019 after making the leap from banking. My Wells Fargo experience really helped a lot just from the standpoint of getting to know people well in the community, especially the business community, Lawson says. It gave me a wider horizon in being comfortable in working with a diverse range of businesses. The Cary Chamber, currently with more than 1,200 members, is making sure we're doing everything we can to put Cary in the best light possible for attracting new businesses, Lawson says, adding that being chamber president is the honor of my career. And that light keeps getting brighter. No more is Cary just a bedroom community to Raleigh and Research Triangle Park, as more and more businesses want to call Cary home. And that has led to a rush of residents and developers. The town added around 40,000 people between 2010 and 2020, according to U.S. Census data, as its population swelled to around 170,000. Now, Cary has to balance its small-town feel that so many residents love with the demands of major growth. We spent a lot of time talking with our business community, Lawson says. As the area continues to grow, that means local businesses need to adapt. Adapting is something businesses have been forced to do in the past 2 years, and he calls the Cary business community very resilient. But 2021 brought new challenges that will extend into the new year. Lawson says the biggest issues he sees in 2022 are the ongoing supply chain disruption and the potential for rising interest rates. Also, the region's housing shortage is a constant topic of discussion in terms of business recruitment. He expects the town's rapid growth to continue, including a lot of great company announcements this year, he says. Even so, Lawson says, as we continue to physically grow corporately, I think we're going to be able to maintain that small-town feel, small-town charm. Next, we have a profile of Michael Smith of Chatham County, written by Evan Hoopfer. 2021 was a banner year for Central North Carolina. Apple announced 3,000 new jobs in Research Triangle Park. Google is bringing 1,000 engineers to Durham, and Toyota capped off the year by announcing a 1,750-job, $1.29 billion manufacturing plant in Randolph County. Chatham County will help make 2022 another year to remember for the region. That's according to Michael Smith, president of the Chatham Economic Development Corporation. He was brought on to the role in January 2021. One of Smith's chief goals is marketing the county's two mega sites, Triangle Innovation Point in Moncur and the Chatham-Siler City Advanced Manufacturing, or CAM, site. Does he think 2022 is the year a mega site lands a company? Yes, Smith says. Because of the numbers that we've seen in 2021, he adds, there's never been this level of activity, large-scale activity, that is interested in both of those sites. The law of averages is on our side. I can't help but believe we have an opportunity to land something big at one of those two sites. The mega sites have been pitched but ultimately passed over for some massive economic development projects recently. Public records show local sites were pitched for both Tesla's $1.1 billion gigafactory that went to Austin, Texas, and Peloton's 2,100-job manufacturing plant that went to Ohio. One of the factors Chatham County has going for it is its ample and growing housing stock, Smith says. Chatham Park will bring 22,000 new homes to Pittsburgh at full build-out, and several other housing developments have popped up recently as homebuyers seek cheaper options than what Wake, Durham, and Orange counties have to offer. When large employers look to either of our megasites to try and figure out if one of these projects come, where are my people going to live? It's a great story to say, look, we've already got all these here, Smith says. He and the team at Chatham EDC are ratcheting up outreach efforts. In October, county leaders unveiled plans for Accelerate 2026. The initiative is a public-private partnership aiming to bring 2,000 jobs and $500 million in new capital investment to Chatham County. Part of the effort is raising $900,000 from the private sector, which will be used for marketing, improvements to the Chatham EDC website, and to make sure Chatham County is part of national site selection events. A focus of Accelerate 2026, the county's two mega sites, Smith says. Now we have a profile of Kamala Subramaniam of Google. This is written by Lauren Onasorge. As Google finalizes plans for a massive cloud engineering hub in Durham, the pressure is heating up for newly tapped site leader Kamala Subramaniam, a five-year Google veteran, was named Google Engineering Site Lead for the Durham operation in July, and all eyes will be on her as Google breaks out of stealth mode and expands in a very big and very public way in the Bull City. Subramaniam brings with her quite a California resume, one with stints at Microsoft and Alcatel-Lucent. But she also knows the triangle, having received both a master's and a doctorate degree in computer engineering from NC State University, where she serves on the school's Computer Science Strategic Advisory Board. She has not been made available for interviews. But the stakes are high in getting hired as Google works to build out its Durham office, expected to someday mean 1,000 jobs. Public records show Google, unlike other trophy projects landed in 2021, such as Apple and Fujifilm Diosynth Biotechnologies, never pursued state incentives. There was no behind-the-scenes rally from economic developers this time, but the state was clearly pushing for the project, as NC Department of Commerce Secretary Michelle Baker Sanders met with Google prior to the announcement, and Governor Roy Cooper had been appealing to the company for some time, including during a 2018 trip to California. And the state has felt the sting of failure before, as records from 2019 show Google had considered and then rejected the state for a major expansion. With the Durham Hub, Google is trying to grow its cloud presence in North Carolina, building an ecosystem of academia, the industry, and the local communities. In a statement over the summer, Google said she will be leading that effort, focusing on research, scientific discovery, and technological advancement, all with a keen focus on diversity and inclusion. And finally, we have a profile of Dana Wooten, Clayton Chamber. This is written by Evan Hoopfer. Johnston County is rapidly evolving from an agriculture-focused economy to one that's becoming more developed by the day. Therefore, county leaders are embarking on something new, a program called Launch JOCO, focused on nurturing and growing the county's small business sector. I really love the fact that this program will give Johnston County an opportunity to diversify its business owners and give an opportunity for people who may not have had an opportunity to start their business and give them the tools they need, says Dana Wooten, president and CEO of the Clayton Chamber of Commerce. I really am excited about that piece. Wooten took over leadership of the chamber of the fast-growing town in 2016 and has seen interest in Clayton soar from both a residential and commercial standpoint. Toward the end of 2021, plans were approved by the town council for the Copper District, which will bring some of the first Class A office space to Johnston County. And local home builders like Riverwild are capitalizing on the increased demand for new housing by planning to build hundreds of new homes in Clayton. The town's economy is becoming both larger and more diversified. The county leadership wants to make sure small businesses don't get left behind. The Clayton Chamber of Commerce is helping organize the Launch JOCO program, which provides opportunities for local entrepreneurs to take classes at Johnston Community College's Small Business Center, as well as network and learn from business leaders in the community. The program is free and kicks off in January. She says the program received 38 applicants and up to 30 students will be selected. One of the main components of the program is the mentorship aspect, as students can learn from established business people. They will be a resource for any information or connections that this particular business owner needs to make, Wooten says. The Launch My City program got started in Detroit and has been in Wake County for a few years. In Wake, the program is hosted by several municipalities like Launch Raleigh, Launch Cary, and Launch Apex, for example. Several other organizations are part of Launch JOCO, and KS Bank signed on as the presenting sponsor for the inaugural class, Wooten says. And Nuvo Solutions is signed on as a gold sponsor. Wooten is excited for how both Launch JOCO and the town of Clayton will continue to evolve in 2022. We're excited to see how this program develops, she says. I hope that it grows and continues to improve. I'm just anxious to see where it goes in 2022. And now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. Beer to go in Greensboro. Greensboro is using a new North Carolina law as a way to try to juice interest in downtown. Starting March 1, the city will have a social district in a key sliver of downtown, which will allow you to take your beer or drink out of a restaurant or pub and walk on public streets. The alcohol is allowed from noon to 9 p.m. The Greensboro City Council approved the measure 7-2 in December. There are some limitations, such as drinks that are no more than 16 ounces. It's an interesting move for the Gate City, which was once one of North Carolina's most prosperous cities, but other markets, such as the Triangle and Charlotte, have long since surged ahead and seen their downtowns prosper, and downtown Winston-Salem is seeing a renaissance as well. Greensboro is jumping on a new law designed to help revive areas that need help. The bill allowing such social districts rose from the North Carolina House in May and was signed into law in September. In a nutshell, we see this as continuing the energy and vibe and attractiveness of downtown. We see this as an added bonus for retailers in commingling with restaurants. Zach Matheny, CEO and president of Downtown Greensboro Incorporated, told the Triad Business Journal. New look from the roof in Chapel Hill. A beloved Chapel Hill rooftop restaurant has reopened, giving fans a spot to once again watch basketball games. Top of the Hill restaurant and brewery was closed for about 20 days while the interior underwent renovations. Floor manager Biagio Ambrosino says the restaurant welcomed customers back on December 30. The renovations included new floors, a fresh coat of paint on the walls, and remodeling the bathrooms. Customers will also find new chairs, bar stools, and tables inside. The improvements aim to give the dining room a different and refreshed look, Ambrosino says. Located at 100 East Franklin Street, Top of the Hill has been a Tar Heel favorite since Scott Maitland, then a UNC law student, opened it in 1996. According to its website, the spot is the eighth oldest surviving brewery in North Carolina. In 2012, the company launched a distillery, Topo, T-O-P-O, Organic Spirits Distillery, currently located a few blocks down from the restaurant at 505 West Franklin Street. Downtown Raleigh sees surge in 2021. The business scene in downtown Raleigh is starting to surge again after the pandemic and the riots after George Floyd's death hit the city's central business district hard. In 2019, downtown saw 48 businesses open or expand and 35 close, a net of 13 businesses that Will Gaskins of the Downtown Raleigh Alliance says is fairly normal. In 2020, those numbers skidded to 38 that opened or expanded, 44 that closed, for a total loss of 6 businesses. But 2021 saw a positive trend. Gaskins, the DRA's Vice President of Economic Development and Planning, notes that 57 storefront businesses opened or expanded and only 21 closed. He notes that many of those opening stores and restaurants are local entrepreneurs, often looking for smaller spaces in the 1,500 to 2,000 square foot range. Help still wanted across the triangle. If your business still has help wanted signs out after the holidays, you aren't alone. Indeed.com, which connects workers and employers, reports that as of December 31, job postings based in North Carolina were 66.95% higher than they were February 1, 2020, or right before the pandemic hit. Job postings for Raleigh are up 58.71% over the same time frame. Nationally, the postings are up 64%, an Indeed spokeswoman says. Golf comes to Keenan Stadium, of all places. Football stadiums sit empty for most of the year, so it's interesting that some are now looking at a novel way to draw fans. Golf. Keenan Stadium will be home to a unique event in March, Top Golf Live, which offers fans a chance to hit golf balls from the concourse of the University of Carolina's football stadium in an event that will include food, music, and beverage options. According to Top Golf's website, the event begins on Thursday, March 3rd and runs through March 6th. Tickets are $65 plus a $13.66 fee, according to the Top Golf website. General public tickets go on sale January 7. Top Golf has a similar program running soon at the home of the Los Angeles Dodgers and Seattle Mariners baseball teams and on the college campuses at the University of Mississippi and the University of Auburn. In a release, Top Golf said, "Players enjoy a one-of-a-kind opportunity to tee it up inside fan-favorite stadiums, hitting golf balls into on-field targets placed between 60 and 140 yards from the tee box. Top Tracer technology accurately traces the flight path of golf balls, instantly scoring every shot in an interactive in-stadium game designed for all skill levels." Carolina Hurricanes owner Tom Dundon is a primary investor in Top Golf. And finally, we have a big number, $100 billion. That's how much First Citizens Bank has in assets now that it has closed on its buyout of New York-based CIT Group. The deal was announced in October 2022. in October 2021, but delays pushed the closing to January 3rd. First Citizens is now the largest family-owned bank in the country. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to the Viewpoint page to read the editor's notebook, written by Sugata Mukherjee, editor-in-chief of the Triangle Business Journal. CHIPS incentive bill needs to become law. On January 4, an American company lost a record it held for almost 100 years. General Motors posted its year-end sales, and it came about 5% lower than Toyota Motor Corporation. GM sold 2.2 million vehicles during 2021, about 115,000 vehicles short of Toyota's numbers. So now we talk about the fading dominance of U.S. automakers in the U.S. In 2005, Toyota was ranked fourth behind GM, Ford, and Daimler Chrysler, with the three U.S. automakers owning a 57% share of the U.S. market. The same three, Daimler has a new European owner called Stellantis, today own only 38% of the market. But it looks like some of it, at least last year, was self-inflicted wounds. While Toyota is very careful in violently waving pom-poms in front of the U.S. consumer, GM officials admitted the lack of supply of semiconductor chips in the second half of the year forced rolling shutdowns of auto production across the U.S. Other automakers have said the same in recent months. And that's where my main point enters. We need more semiconductor chips made in the U.S. and delivered to U.S. companies. That requires super expensive capital commitment up front and high labor costs that many chip makers in the U.S. believe becomes cost prohibitive. So they rely on Asian suppliers. According to the Semiconductor Industry Association, domestic chip making accounted for 37% of the world's supplies in 1990. Now the industry estimates that number could go down to as much as 10% by 2030 if nothing is done. So lawmakers introduced a bill in early 2021 called the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, USICA, and nestled inside that bill was the Creating Helpful Incentives to Produce Semiconductors, or CHIPS, for America Act. The Congressional Budget Office estimated the CHIPS Act would cost taxpayers $52 billion. The broader bill tab is about $250 billion. In June, the U.S. Senate passed the bill. Now it is stuck in the House of Representatives. But the sausage-making process in Washington has made the bill a leverage tool to pass other legislation by adding to the USICA text. Both Democrats and Republicans need to understand that if nothing is done in moving the USICA bill, GM will not be the only U.S. company losing ground in 2022. Companies such as Apple and Google, to every large U.S. producer of goods that uses electronic chips in their products, would lose to counterparts in Asia. That could ultimately result in the loss of capital investments and jobs in the U.S. To pass a $250 billion bill does not come without a catch, and understandably, the Democrats and the Republicans in Washington may be trying to use that leverage. But if they wait too long, large economic development projects may head overseas, thus dampening the chances of the great American recovery. Lawmakers should use the provisions in the bill to put pressure on corporations that spend billions of dollars on stock buybacks to pad their investors rather than invest in research and development. In the past 10 years, more than $250 billion in stock buybacks were initiated by U.S. corporations. Maybe a provision to limit the stock buybacks can be inserted in the bill for companies looking for the incentive. But something needs to be done now before U.S. corporations are further embarrassed in their own land by not being able to hold on to their market share because of supply chain issues. And with our remaining minutes, we'll read as much of this related story as we can. Chatham Megasite finalist for a big chip-making plant. The deal could mean a $40 billion-plus plant and thousands of jobs, written by Evan Hoopfer and Lauren Onasorge. A U.S. semiconductor company is scouting a Chatham County site for what could be among the largest economic development projects in North Carolina history. The project, if it comes to fruition, could have a capital investment of $40 billion or more, with 5,000 to 10,000 jobs at full build-out. Multiple sources tell Triangle Business Journal the project is on an accelerated timeline as the country and the world rushes to fill the gap in the global chip shortage that's hampering the economic recovery and causing supply chain disruption. citing non-disclosure agreements with various parties, including the company and site selection officials. Sources would not confirm the name of the company, but confirmed it is a U.S. chip maker. Cities in Texas, Arizona, California are also vying for the project, sources added. Last October, CEO Sanjay Mehrotra of Boise, Idaho-based Micron Technology, one of the world's largest chipmakers, announced the company's intent to invest more than $150 billion globally over the next decade in memory manufacturing and research and development. On an earnings call in December, Mehrotra said the firm looked forward to working with governments around the world, including the U.S., as we consider sites to support future expansion. When asked if the company was considering North Carolina for a facility, a Micron spokesperson says the company is vetting opportunities around the world and weighing many factors such as access to a strong talent pool, reliable and cost-competitive utility services, alignment with our corporate sustainability objectives, and a favorable regulatory environment. In the U.S., we're engaging in discussions with multiple states and will provide updates as the process continues and at the appropriate time, the spokesperson adds. The North Carolina project, dubbed Project Autumn, has zeroed in on the former Moncure megasite, now called Triangle Innovation Point, the 2,150-acre site in southeast Chatham near the Lee County line has been viewed for years as a prime location for a large economic development project. Multiple government and industry sources have said interest in the site has picked up recently. "We do have some pretty significant activity on it," says Chet Mann, mayor of nearby Sanford. "I think it's safe to say it's a matter of when, not if," he says. Proposed law is essential. Sources say the semiconductor project is tied to the passage of the CHIPS Act, federal legislation designed to spur investment in domestic chip manufacturing. Over the past several decades, the U.S.'s share of the global chip industry has shrunk as semiconductor companies chose to invest in manufacturing plants overseas. The U.S. Senate passed the legislation last June. It was included in the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, which includes $52 billion to fund provisions in the CHIPS Act. But the bill has stalled with congressional leaders in the House of Representatives. Also in June, the Senate introduced the Facilitating American-Built Semiconductors, or FABS Act, legislation that would establish an investment tax credit to incentivize greater semiconductor manufacturing in the United States. Virtually all of the major semiconductor makers in the U.S. are now working to bring more production stateside. And we'll stop there as the rest of the story goes into more of the history of semiconductors in the U.S. Finally, we have the Business Pulse. The question, will you be looking for a new job or career in 2022? 201 responses, 45% say no. 37% say yes, and 18% say they're considering it. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Triangle Journal is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. So long until next time, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.